Trump approaches 100 days, Congress approaches a potential shutdown, and we approach another special congressional election. It's a very approachable edition of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. It's time for a first semester report card for President Trump. How do we grade him?
Boy, I give him a big incomplete based on his own standards. The problem is that for Donald Trump, everything has to be the biggest and the most fabulous and the most successful ever. And he set a very high bar for himself.
Plus, in Nebraska, a race for mayor of Omaha has exposed a continued fault line in the Democratic Party.
If you have a rally in which you have the labor movement and environmentalists and the African-American community and the Latino community coming together saying, we want this guy to become our next mayor. Should I reject going there to Omaha? I don't think so.
And there's a reason why the gold standard for a president's first 100 days remains Franklin D. Roosevelt.
He got 15 major pieces of legislation through Congress in his first 100 days. And in comparison to other presidents, Roosevelt set the standard and it made his successors annoyed.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 176 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The countdown to President Trump's first 100 days in office has been a nonstop obsession, not only for the media and historians, but for Trump himself. Trump was clearly focusing on it during the campaign. Here he is at a rally in Minneapolis.
Think about what we can accomplish in the first 100 days of a Trump administration.
Or in Golden, Colorado.
Just think about what we can accomplish in the first 100 days.
And how has he done? Here's Trump's own review in a speech this week.
No administration has accomplished more in the first 90 days. That includes on military, on the border, on trade, on regulation, on law enforcement.
And in an interview with Maria Bartiromo on the Fox Business Network.
We have done so much for so many people. I don't think that there is a presidential period of time in the first 100 days where anyone's done nearly what we've been able to do.
But now, the president calls the 100-day marker a, quote, ridiculous standard, even as he tries to get as much done in the few days he has left before day 100 on Saturday. Ridiculous standard or not, Mara Liasson knows a thing or two about presidential administrations. As NPR's national political correspondent and White House correspondent before that, she witnessed firsthand the first 100 days of presidents going back to Bill Clinton. Mara, it's great having you back on The Political Junkie.
It's great to be here.
I wrote something on social media the other day, and I want to know what you think of it. And I said that I also thought the 100-day marker was arbitrary and often meaningless. But then I got a pushback from those who said, well, Trump has been raising expectations about it, so it's disingenuous of him to suddenly say it's bogus. First, let me ask you, what's your view on making this a standard?
Well, first of all, I think it is bogus. I think it's totally arbitrary. And I think if you were going to judge the success or failure of an administration, I think a year would be a lot better time frame. But it's a traditional report card. And Donald Trump fell right into the 100-day trap because he did talk so much about it. You know, he both doesn't want to be measured by this metric because he knows he hasn't passed a lot, and passing things usually is how we measure success or failure of an administration, even though the White House would argue, and I think many conservatives would agree, that just putting Neil Gorsuch on the court and getting rid of a lot of Obama-era regulations is success enough for them, even if he didn't do anything else at all. But he fell right into the trap. He talked about it a lot. He is somebody who's obsessed with his box office, with his reviews, with his scorecard, and he wants to run up the score. The problem is that he doesn't have a lot of opportunities to pass things, but what he can do and what he does do is create the impression of tremendous action. Even if it's without consequence, he's always doing something, signing something, even if what he's signing is just to direct an agency to make a study of something else. Today he rolled out his tax reform plan. That's a big deal, but all he did was announce it. He hasn't passed it.
But if there's no budget deal by the weekend, then I'm sure they'll work something out. But if there's no deal, who gets blamed for it? You can't blame the Democrats. You know, Republicans control everything.
Keeping the government open is the most basic function of government, and Republicans control all branches of the government. If the government shuts down, which I agree with you, I do not think it will, the Republicans are going to get blamed. However, keeping the government open and passing another omnibus bill does not go into your success column for the 100 days. That's something that the government is just supposed to do. It's kind of like waking up and brushing your teeth.
Well, I don't do that either, but let's focus on Donald Trump. I mean, when he was running for office, he promised something new. And I think for the most part, we've seen something new, whatever that means. But again, in this arbitrary marking period, what kind of a grade would you give him?
Boy, I give him a big incomplete based on his own standards that he laid out for himself. The problem is that for Donald Trump, everything has to be the biggest and the most fabulous and the most successful ever. And he set a very high bar for himself. He was going to do a lot of things on day one, and he was going to get a lot of things done by the 100th day. And he hasn't done that. When you talk about something new, one of the things I worked on this week for our 100-day series of pieces was whether we understand what it is that Donald Trump has offered that is new. In other words, is there such a thing as Trumpism? He ran as somebody who was going to be different than any other president. He was going to bring a businessman sensibility to the White House. He was going to bust through the old definitions of the two parties. He was going to put together this new nationalist, populist, slightly isolationist America First party. He was going to transform the Republican Party into a workers' party. And I would think by that measure, he hasn't succeeded. I think in some ways, he's morphed into a more traditional, conventional Republican administration with some nativist flourishes like the mini trade wars that he started with Canada and very, very, very tough immigration rhetoric and actions. So I guess I would say that he's starting to look like a xenophobic version of what the Mitt Romney administration would be like. Conventional foreign policy and tough immigration and trade.
I'm going to get to the foreign policy in a second, but would you call the failed effort to get a health care bill passed, would you call it a defeat or a temporary setback? I mean, I can't imagine the Republicans not having a replacement for the Affordable Care Act.
At this point, I'd have to say it's a temporary setback since they're working very hard to get another version that they can bring to the floor and pass. They also really need it, not only because it was their number one campaign promise that they ran on for the last 7 years, but also because they need some kind of incredible amount, like $900 billion of tax cuts, that if they can extract those out of Obamacare, out of repealing Obamacare, they'll be in a lot better shape to pass a tax bill, a tax reform bill. So I do think they want to do it. There are a lot of conservatives who think it was better that the first Obamacare replacement bill didn't pass because it was so unpopular and it would have hurt Republicans. But it looks like they're trying to get something together that can pass the House at least. Certainly, the president wanted it. He talked about possibly having a vote this week. That was something that Paul Ryan didn't agree with. He said, we'll bring it to the floor when we have the votes, and we don't yet. But I think the president wanted it for two reasons. He wanted it because it made tax reform a lot more easy. But he wanted it because that would have been a big marker that he could do what he promised to do. And that was a big setback, maybe not in the larger scheme of things, but that was the first thing that the unified Republican government tried to do, and it failed.
You mentioned earlier about foreign policy. I mean, we've seen his response to the use of chemical weapons in Syria. We've seen the dropping of that mother of all bombs in Afghanistan, which is perhaps more aggressive than we expected him to be, but he did say he would bomb the heck out of ISIS, and maybe that's what the bomb in Afghanistan was. But what about those who say that his response to North Korea is Korea with an R? He's almost like too casual when he's talking about nuclear confrontation.
Well, I think that North Korea is a huge problem. It's the most urgent problem facing the United States, and it's different in degree and kind from anything that he faces in Syria or Afghanistan. You know, in Syria, he did something that a lot of Obama's own advisors thought he should have done, which is when Bashar al-Assad used chemical weapons, he crossed a line and he should have been punished, and Donald Trump bombed an airfield when he did that. Now, you can't just do that to North Korea and get them to give up their nuclear weapons. They could destroy Seoul in about an hour. So North Korea has been much less sure-footed. I think that's because his options are so poor. There's so few of them, and all of them are terrible. He did announce famously that there was a, quote, armada heading to North Korea. Turns out it wasn't heading there. It did get there eventually. And even when it got there, it wasn't armed with the kinds of things that could shoot North Korean missiles out of the sky. So on that one, it seems like the president's policy, even though he says the era of strategic patience is over, it seems like the president's policy on North Korea is really to just hope and pray that the Chinese can fix it for us.
You mentioned earlier about executive orders, and he's done a lot of things he said he would do with the oil pipeline, environmental standards, the travel ban. Even if he didn't get the travel ban pushed through, this is the kind of stuff he said he would do. And as you point out, he did get Neil Gorsuch on the court. But one of the things he ran on was the famous wall. And that almost seems like he's willing to say, okay, well, either never mind or I'll worry about it later.
Well, you know, what's interesting about that is that Donald Trump said that he was a fabulous negotiator. He wrote The Art of the Deal, and that's what he was going to do. He was going to make great deals for the American people. He has not succeeded in negotiating anything yet. And on the wall, it seems like he was negotiating with himself. First, he said he insisted that it be in the government funding bill that has to be passed by midnight. And then he said, oh, never mind. We can do it in the fall. So he called his own bluff. It's really extraordinary. He negotiates with himself, and then he backs down. The thing about that that's interesting to me is that Republicans and Democrats are really taking the measure of Donald Trump. And when he first came in, it seemed like he could intimidate a major American corporation with a tweet. He could move markets. He could cause stock prices to go down. But over time, I think people have started to view his bark as worse than his bite, basically. And the wall is a perfect example. He said he would even possibly risk a government shutdown in order to get funding for the wall, which, by the way, he had said during the campaign, Mexico would pay for. But in the end, he backed off.
And on those things where he's accused of flip-flopping, I think calling China a currency manipulator comes to mind. But he, you know, he says one thing and then he changes his mind. Would you say it's flip-flopping, or does he have these instincts that pull him all over the map?
Well, I think it is flip-flopping. He does have instincts that pull him all over the map. It's kind of incoherent. But on the other hand, the currency manipulation thing with China was interesting because China hasn't been manipulating its currency for many years. It used to, and Donald Trump insisted that it still was. And he said that he would declare China a currency manipulator on day one. Well, it turns out he needed China's help on North Korea. So he said, look, I'm not going to declare you a currency manipulator because you're helping on North Korea. And that's my first priority. So that's, you know, that's what I did. Then when pressed and asked, gee, do you think that they were a currency manipulator and you didn't call them that because you wanted help on North Korea? Or did you come to understand that they actually weren't manipulating their currency? And what he has said, at least in the AP interview on Friday, was, well, they were manipulating their currency until I got inaugurated.
That was a remarkable interview, wasn't it?
Oh, my God. That was an amazing interview. It was, you know what it reminded me of? The one and only full-fledged press conference that he's done, and the one in February, where he just very rambling, very discursive, just goes on and on. And all of his insecurities and neuroses and grievances are on display.
You know, he always talks about the campaign is over, get over it, and yet he'll always keep talking about...
No, he can't get over it. He has to, you know, I don't think that there's been a major interview or a press conference where he hasn't repeated his great Electoral College victory.
And it's funny, when he'll talk about the greatest landslide and the greatest crowds and the greatest inaugural, you know, crowds and all that thing, doesn't he set himself up for ridicule, saying he's accomplished more in his first 100 days than anyone else, when it's clearly, I mean, by any standard, let alone just not even FDR's, but any standard, that is just so false.
Yeah, I say this is like reality television without the television. I mean, reality matters. And if you are a reality TV celebrity, it doesn't matter so much. You can keep on huffing and puffing and bluffing and hyperbolizing and selling and exaggerating, and it's all part of the show. But reality matters. And what's happened, when you talk about people not taking him seriously, the markets are no longer reacting to every single thing he says. And there was this Trump boost. The markets expected tax cuts and deregulation, and they were very excited about that. And then they backed off a little bit. And what's interesting is that when I said that Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill are really taking his measure, if they come to believe that he doesn't really mean what he says, he doesn't stick to his guns, that's going to affect him in the future when he asks them to cast tough, unpopular votes for him.
Mara Liasson is NPR's national political correspondent. Mara, as always, thanks for your insight.
Thanks for having me.
And remember, enjoy the next 1,361 days.
So before we end and then begin, we'll drink a toast to how it's been. A few more hours to be complete. A few more nights on satin sheets. A few more times that I can say I've loved these days.
If you've loved these days, maybe you'll love this week's trivia question. Of all the 44 presidents, William Henry Harrison never got to experience his first 100 days. He died 31 days into his term in 1841. So here's the question. Who was the most recent vice president who served fewer than 100 days in office? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
Glory days. Well, it passes you by. Glory days. In the wonder of a young girl's eye. Glory days. Glory days.
Aside from the shoutings of a former quarterback from the Denver Broncos, you don't hear much about Omaha lately. But next month's mayoral election in Nebraska's largest city has exposed serious fault lines in the Democratic Party, reminding us it's not just the GOP that has internal battles. Basically, it comes down to this. Heath Mello is the Democratic nominee in Omaha's May 9th election. He's on record as having supported a bill that would require doctors to inform women about receiving ultrasounds before getting an abortion. But Mello is strongly backed by Bernie Sanders, whose popularity has not diminished even after his failed 2016 bid for the White House. Sanders was then met with a lot of criticism from pro-choice activists. Sanders has been on a cross-country come-together-and-fight-back tour with DNC Chair Tom Perez, designed to strengthen the Democratic Party. But while on the tour, Perez said that the party should not be supporting any candidates who don't back abortion rights. And that upset party regulars who wanted to know if the chairman was writing off Democratic senators such as Bob Casey, Joe Manchin, Joe Donnelly, and others who oppose abortion rights and are up in 2018. These are just some of the questions I'm quite confident Aaron Blake, the political reporter with the Washington Post, will be able to answer with no problem. Right, Aaron?
I'll do my best.
Well, let's start at the beginning. First of all, Sanders and Perez are not exactly the best of buddies, right? I mean, Sanders backed Keith Ellison for DNC chair over Perez.
Right. It's something of an uneasy combination, if for no other reason than, you know, Sanders isn't technically a Democrat, which he reinforced during his Unity Tour when he was on Chris Hayes' show. And he's, doing the Unity Tour for the Democratic Party. So you're right. Some interesting dynamics there dating back to the 2016 primary, and certainly not always on the same page on some of the issues, too.
And how much does it matter as he's going around touting a Democratic Party unity? How much does it matter that he's not a Democrat?
I don't think it matters to Democrats a whole lot. I think he speaks their language on these issues. The independent thing is kind of he's been known for it his whole career, and he's not going to change, basically. But he's, for all intents and purposes, a leader of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. And so this was an interesting kind of development for him to go out and try to rally the party faithful, try to unite them behind a platform. But as we found out, not a whole lot of unification on issues like abortion, and certainly not unified when Sanders was questioning whether John Ossoff, the special election candidate in Georgia, was actually a progressive. So some stumbles along the way, certainly.
Well, that's a good question, too. I mean, While Sanders is backing Mello in Omaha, he suggested that Ossoff was not sufficiently progressive, and he refused to campaign for him. So, I mean, why do you embrace Mello but hesitate on Ossoff? I don't understand that.
It made no sense at the time. I think in his heart of hearts, I think Bernie Sanders would maybe say, if he were being completely honest, that he was more suspect about John Ossoff's economic progressive credentials. He's certainly not as much of a Bernie Sanders, that is certainly not as much of a social conservative on issues like guns and abortion, though he is pro-choice, of course. So I think he really cares mostly about economic issues, and that's why he was behind Mello, but not Ossoff. But it was conspicuous, to say the least.
What struck you more, the fact that Sanders was backing a pro-life candidate, or Perez said there was no room in the party for pro-life candidates?
I was more surprised by what Perez said. That is a large declaration to make in today's Democratic Party, to basically write off a bunch of candidates, including incumbent members of Congress who do oppose abortion rights. Polls show about one-fourth of the Democratic base opposes abortion rights. That number is larger when you look at the Hispanic population, you look at the African American population. So these are big segments of the party base, and I think it's unusual that he would make that declaration without clearing it apparently with other leaders in the party and having them behind it. I think it was an overreaction to kind of the momentary controversy of the day having to do with Heath Mello.
Well, CBS's John Dickerson asked Sanders about his backing of a pro-life candidate on Face the Nation. Sanders said it was a no-brainer.
If we are going to become a 50-state party, if you're going to go to Omaha, Nebraska, which has a Republican governor, two Republican senators, all Republican congresspeople, Republican legislature, you know what? And if in Omaha 5 or 6,000 people come out to a rally led by Jane Cleave, their new Democratic chairperson, is doing a great job. And if you have a rally in which you have the labor movement and environmentalists and Native Americans and the African American community and the Latino community coming together saying, we want this guy to become our next mayor, should I reject going there to Omaha? I don't think so. It was a great rally, and I hope very much he wins. And by the way, his opponent, the incumbent mayor, is also, of course, anti-choice, and she is inviting Scott Walker, one of the most reactionary anti-choice governors, anti-labor governors, anti-education governors, to campaign for her. The choice is clear.
I think, Aaron, you probably agree with that. I think you're saying that's more understandable, certainly, than Perez writing off pro-life Democrats.
Yeah, I think so. I think, though, it's interesting to see Sanders say something like that. It's something of a slippery slope, because will you compromise on abortion in this race? Will you compromise on increasing the minimum wage in this race in order to get somebody elected? It's all a matter of where you draw the line and what you insist upon. Democrats have to win in conservative areas, so they have to make these compromises in order to win back the House and win back the Senate. The question is on which issues you're going to allow them to compromise, on which issues are not litmus test issues for you. And I think Sanders certainly has some litmus test issues on things like the economy, whereas on others like abortion, apparently, and guns, of course, where he's been a Second Amendment supporter, certainly in his career, he just doesn't have the same convictions on those, that those are the most important issues.
And of course, you can make the case that if you write off pro-life Democrats, you can forget about Nancy Pelosi or Chuck Schumer ever having a majority in their chambers, right?
Yeah, I think so. If you look at what happened in 2006, 2008, Democrats got their majorities in large part because they recruited socially conservative candidates who were able to win in the South and along the Rust Belt. Republicans got back the House and Senate by knocking off some of those members, but that's really the path to the majority for Democrats, and so they do need to be somewhat willing to compromise on those particular issues, and we have a very good example of when that paid off for them less than a decade ago.
There was also controversy in the Democratic Party, or among the Democratic Party leadership, that they could have done more. Certainly in the Kansas special election, maybe in Georgia as well. What's your report card? What's your grade of the Democrats in the special elections we've seen so far?
Yeah, you know, I think overall it's been a good special election season for them. They've certainly showed that they have a little bit more jump in their step than Republicans do 6 months into the Trump presidency. I'm not sure that Kansas was a winnable race, even if they had gone in big there. It wasn't like it was a 1 or 2 point race in the end. It was a wider margin than that. And generally, you can only move numbers so much with advertising campaigns. Georgia, you know, I have a little bit of a different take on Georgia than some folks do. It's obviously been a very conservative district over the years. Republicans usually won it with, you know, 60%+ of the vote. Democrats in this case got a combined 49% of the vote, so they did much better than they have in the past. If you look, though, at the numbers, they're very similar to what the presidential race was last year. This was a district that was one of the biggest swings against Republicans in the year of Trump. I think it was number 6 in the country as far as Romney's margin versus Trump's margin. And so if you're going to see a district in which there is going to be a huge shift in a special election like this, this was a really good candidate for it. The question is whether Democrats can transfer that to other districts that maybe aren't as anti-Trump relative to how they usually are. And so I don't think that they can count on overperforming in other districts like they did in Georgia's 6th necessarily.
We've had lots of talk this week about President Trump's 100 days. How would you characterize the Democratic opposition's 100 days?
I think they're trying to figure out what they're all about, you know, whether they just want to oppose everything, which is what they've mostly been doing. Obviously, they had a setback when Republicans did the nuclear option in the Supreme Court debate. That was, you know, of course, the most significant legislative debate that we've had today. I don't know if that was the right move to force that in this particular debate. You get to the next Supreme Court vacancy, and perhaps you still want to have that filibuster in place for a justice who would actually change the balance of the Supreme Court, which Gorsuch did not. But then at that point, you know, if they had just waited to filibuster until then, you also have to think maybe Republicans would have just gotten rid of the filibuster at that point. I do think it might have been a little bit more difficult if the balance of the court was at stake at that point. But yeah, I think that they're pretty united. They've held the line on things like health care. They're probably going to hold the line on tax reform. And that's what their base wants at this point. So I think that's what we'll continue to see.
Aaron Blake is a senior political reporter on The Fix, which is at The Washington Post. Aaron, thanks as always.
Thank you, Ken.
One place Democrats long controlled, but no longer, is the 5th Congressional District in South Carolina. It's the seat vacated by Mick Mulvaney, now the White House Budget Director. Last year, Mulvaney was reelected with 59% of the vote, and the guess here is that whoever wins next Tuesday's special Republican primary will be the next member of Congress. But the previous incumbent was Democrat John Spratt, the House Budget Committee Chair, who held the seat for 28 years until he lost to Mulvaney in 2010. And Democrats are hoping that GOP intra-party squabbles may help them in the June general election. Bristow Marchant is covering the race for the state newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina, and joins us now. Bristow, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
This race hasn't gotten as much attention as those other special elections in Kansas and Georgia, but there are some fascinating things going on in this contest, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. It's a race that hasn't gotten as much attention as some of these other special elections around the country. But you know, I don't think the Kansas special election got that much attention until right before the vote when it looked like it could actually be competitive. And you know, I don't know if we won't see something similar happen here. Like you mentioned, it was a long time Democratic district, even after a lot of the rest of the state and the rest of the South had switched over to the Republicans. So Democrats are certainly hoping there's some residual goodwill, a residual base of voters there that can turn out and vote for them. It's got a higher percentage African-American population than some of the other special elections you're seeing around the country. So if the same energy you saw in Kansas and you saw in the Georgia special election carries over into South Carolina, at least the Democrats are hoping you'll see a surprising result.
Okay, so right now, I mean, Kansas and Georgia were, you know, the attention they got was because it was Democrat versus Republicans. Now we're just focusing on the primaries and especially the Republican primary. I know there are 7 Republican candidates running, but who are the favorites?
probably the two most well-known candidates in that district are Tommy Pope and Ralph Norman, who are both members of the South Carolina legislature. Norman actually resigned his seat in the legislature in order to run full-time for the seat in Congress. And both of them are longtime representatives from York County, which is right south of Charlotte. It's probably the population center of the district. There's also a former state party chairman, Chad Connolly, who's running for that seat. So those are probably the three best-known, well-established guys out of a crowded field who are running for the seat.
I remember Pope. He was the guy who prosecuted Susan Smith.
Yes, that's probably what he's best known for, you know, statewide and probably nationwide, is he was the prosecutor in the Susan Smith case, the child murder case, about 20 years ago now.
She drowned her two children, right?
Right, and drove the car into a lake. So that's probably where a lot of his name recognition comes from. And if you look at some of the early polling in that district, just kind of checking out people's name recognition, he was obviously head and shoulders above other potential candidates just in terms of how many folks in the state know who he is.
I know a candidate who's not as well known is a conservative activist by the name of Sherry Few. And I've seen some of her ads about the Confederate flag and the murders at the Emanuel AME Church in Charleston. Let me play one of them.
When Ralph Norman and Tommy Pope voted to take the battle flag down from the Confederate Memorial in Columbia, they started a war on our history. Now they're renaming streets and colleges and destroying monuments to Confederate soldiers. And it started with Ralph Norman and Tommy Pope's vote. I'm Sherry Few. I'm running for Congress and approve this message because it's time for leaders to stand up and stop political correctness and fight for what we believe.
Bristow, the refighting the battle over the Confederate flag, I thought that was a resolved issue in South Carolina.
Well, I think a lot of folks did think it was resolved, obviously in 2015 when the flag was taken down from in front of the State House after this terrible shooting at the church in Charleston. There was a bit of grumbling at the time. The flag still has its supporters in South Carolina, and there was talk about, you know, primary challenges for lawmakers who had voted to take it down, which Pope and Norman did in the legislature. That really didn't play out in any of the statewide races last year in 2016, but it looks like Sherry Few has decided this is an issue that she can use to kind of separate herself from those two candidates and also make herself maybe sound a little tougher than some of the other candidates running here. And you mentioned Sherry Few might not be very well known outside South Carolina. She's a longtime activist here. She campaigned against the Common Core education standards, and she was actually a candidate in the GOP primary for the state superintendent of education a couple years ago, but obviously didn't get the nomination. But I think she's built up a bit of a name for herself in state politics prior to this run.
If the flag is not a key issue, what are the key issues in the race?
I think you're probably going to see a lot of the same issues that you've seen in other races nationwide. Especially conservative Republican voters are looking at what's going on in Washington. They're talking about this ongoing effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act. They're talking about a lot of immigration and border issues that are obviously very prominent right now. And I think there's been kind of a trend among the Republican candidates to try to appeal to the Donald Trump voter in the 5th District. There's been a lot of talk about, you know, law and order issues, security issues, and some of the campaigning that's been going on, and just a general attempt by a lot of these candidates to position themselves to kind of fit within Donald Trump's new Republican Party.
Is Trump still popular in South Carolina and in the district?
I haven't seen any recent polling on that specific to the 5th District. I know statewide, his numbers are a little mixed. There was a poll by Winthrop University just came out a week or two ago that I'm just going off of memory, I think showed him at about 47% disapproval and 43 or 44% approval in the state, which is not necessarily the numbers you'd expect a Republican president to have, but I think he's always been kind of a divisive figure. So it's in line with what you'd see nationwide and probably in a lot of other states.
And who are the Democrats who are running?
I think probably the most prominent Democrat running, the only one right now who has ads up on TV, is Archie Parnell, who is a former financial advisor for Goldman Sachs. He's running on his business record, his expertise in the tax field. He's a former tax attorney, and he's a native of Sumter, South Carolina, up here in the district. So He's gotten a lot of attention, and I think he's counting on some national support running in that race. He has two challengers in that district. One is actually a 26-year-old woman, an Army veteran, who's running against him named Alexis Frank, who has a bit of a presence online and in social media, trying to get some support as kind of a young upstart candidate there. And there's also Les Murphy, who is a veterans activist, a Marine, who's been very active with a veterans organization in the district, working in the military community. So those three are going to be kind of vying to see if they can avoid a runoff in that race, because if no candidate gets above 50%, the two top vote getters, both in the Democratic primary and almost certainly in the Republican primary, will have to come back a couple weeks later for the runoff to decide those two nominees.
I mentioned earlier that John Spratt held the seat for 28 years. Does the district look anything like it used to?
It's still, I think the core of the district is still the same. The lines have shifted somewhat since 2010 because there was a redistricting, and South Carolina actually gained a congressional district in the last census. So the lines have shifted a little bit, but the core of it contains about 11 counties. It's really centered on that kind of suburban Charlotte area in the north central part of the state. And then it kind of snakes down to the state capital in Columbia. But I think the demographics may not be as favorable to the Democrats as they used to be, but they're still hopeful that there's some competitive energy there that they can harness in an open seat election, especially one you're probably going to see low turnout, and it's going to be the most passionate people who show up who will decide the outcome.
I know Democrats around the country have been encouraged by how close they came in, or relatively close they came in Kansas and Georgia, but do you think they have a shot in the June special election?
It's going to depend on turnout. It's going to depend on, you know, how much excitement, if you can keep up the same level of activism we've seen recently into another 2 months out now until we get to the general election, where it's going to be one Republican and one Democrat. But it's definitely a district that's been trending red in a state that's been trending red for a long time. So Democrats have kind of a hill to climb to get back into a competitive position in that seat and a lot of the other seats around the state and around the South.
Christo Marchant is a political reporter for the state newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina. Christo, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Ken. I really appreciate it.
By the way, if you want to keep up with when all these primaries and special elections are happening, check out our new Political Junkie calendar. You'll find it at krpoliticaljunkie.com/calendar.
Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who is the most senior member of Congress, House or Senate, who first won his or her seat in a special election? The answer, Don Young. The Alaska Republican, who happens to be the most senior Republican in the House, was first elected in a 1973 special election following the death of Democrat Nick Begich. And the randomly selected winner is Ezra Riley of Shorewood, Wisconsin. Ezra wins the coveted Political Junkie button. And we have a Scuttle button winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. The last contest had a Tow Away Lindsay button from New York City, an I Love Nero button, probably not from the Roman Empire, and a You'd All for President button from 1976. So when you combine Toe with Nero with Mo, that's Mo Udall, of course, you kind of get Tony Romo, the former star quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys, who was released by the team earlier this month. The winner is Kevin Eisenberg of Rochester, New York. We'll have a new Scuttle Button puzzle up on our website this weekend. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Those were the days. Yes, they were. Those were the days.
been hard, if not impossible, to ignore all the talk this week about Trump's first 100 days. What did he accomplish? What did he say he would accomplish? How do you compare him with his predecessors? While that debate goes on, it seems clear that no president has, or perhaps ever will, approached the accomplishments of Franklin D. Roosevelt. The nation's 32nd president, he was elected in 1932 in the midst of the Great Depression.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Elected along with him were a whopping 313 Democrats in the House, a gain of 97 seats, and 59 out of 96 in the Senate, a gain of 12. He had the congressional backing to make things happen, and he took advantage of it. Jonathan Alter is the author of the 2006 bestseller, The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. For nearly 30 years, he was a columnist and senior editor at Newsweek. Now he's a columnist at the Daily Beast, and even more impressive, he's now on the Political Junkie. John, it's great to have you on the program.
Great to be here. I love the show.
Thank you so much. Well, Donald Trump likes to tell everyone he inherited a mess when he became president. I think it's fair to say that Franklin Roosevelt inherited a mess as well.
Yeah, I'm not sure that they're really comparable. When Franklin Roosevelt took office, unemployment was at 25% and headed higher. When Donald Trump took office, unemployment was at 5%. Now, the mess that Barack Obama inherited was a little bit more comparable to what Franklin Roosevelt inherited, but Trump did not inherit a mess, and for him to say that he did is not consistent with the historical reality. We have problems in this country. We have people who have been left behind by a changing economy, but by any historical standard, he did not inherit a mess.
When you think of what Roosevelt was like when he came into office, I mean, unlike Trump, he did have political experience. He was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy. He was the vice presidential nominee in 1920. He was 4 years governor of New York. But wasn't he seen pretty much as a lightweight, somebody who couldn't possibly do the job as if anybody could have done the job?
He was seen as a lightweight. And at the convention where he was nominated on the fourth ballot, a lot of the political reporters, including H.L. Mencken, derided him as being Feather Duster Roosevelt, F.D. Roosevelt. Some people thought that it was a kangaroo ticket, stronger in the hindquarters, which would be the bottom of the ticket, John Nance Garner of Texas, and weaker up front. They actually didn't think that Roosevelt was physically strong enough to go out and campaign around the country, you know, because of all these reports about his polio, and he proved them wrong, and he went out and campaigned vigorously and then, you know, was a very vigorous president.
I was going to say, he was also a great communicator. You know, earlier I played that famous line about the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, but he also said this during that speech, and I want to play that.
This nation is asking for action, and action now.
And he got what he asked for, right? I mean,
yeah.
I guess my question is, what did he accomplish in those famous 100 days?
Well, he used that word action over and over again in his inaugural address, and it actually got more attention at the time than the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, which, when you think about it, was kind of a bit of inspired nonsense, because if you're worried about putting food on the table, that's not fear itself that you're fearing. It's something real.
It's hunger, right.
Hunger. But he got 15 major pieces of legislation through Congress in his first 100 days, and he's the one who coined the expression first 100 days, which he borrowed from Napoleon. And it happened that the special session of Congress that he called ended after 100 days in June of 1933. In those days, the inauguration was on March 4th, so the 100 days ended in June. And there were many pieces of legislation. First, they rescued the banks. Then they rescued farmers. They put through the first regulation of Wall Street. They set up the Civilian Conservation Corps, putting 250,000 young men to work in forests and on the land. Eventually, they planted 3 billion trees, saving the topsoil of the United States. Then there were a series of other major laws that related to the economy, like the establishment of deposit insurance, which helped shore up the banks, although Roosevelt had initially been opposed to federal deposit insurance. And then at the end of the 100 days, and I've left out, you know, many important pieces of legislation, they pushed through what was called the National Recovery Act, which basically regulated every part of the American economy in an effort to raise prices and bring people together to pull out of the Depression. It wasn't actually a very successful piece of legislation, but it was huge, as Donald Trump would say. So in comparison to other presidents, Roosevelt set the standard, and it made his successors annoyed because none of them could possibly accomplish what he did in his first 100 days.
How did he handle Congress? Did he charm them the way Reagan tried to do, or did he bully them, as some said Lyndon Johnson did? I mean, he had an overwhelming Democratic majority in both the House and the Senate.
Yeah, and you would think that they would all just rubber stamp what he did. And when I started working on The Defining Moment, I thought, oh, well, this couldn't have been that hard for him to get all these bills through because he had such an overwhelming Democratic majority. But actually, he had to lobby on almost all of them. Each one of those bills had its own different story of passage, and Roosevelt became a master at playing the politics of Capitol Hill. He was a brilliant politician. He wasn't a brilliant man. He didn't have the highest IQ of anybody in the 20th century in the office, but he was an instinctive and brilliant politician.
In addition to being a great politician, though, I also would have thought that being an aristocrat, he would have had a hard time bonding with all these millions of people who were suffering, and yet he was able to communicate with them as well.
Yeah, so one of the things that happened in the first 100 days was the first fireside chat, and he didn't have as many of those as people remembered.
Wait, he wasn't tweeting?
Well, his version of tweeting was to go on the radio. So he did for radio, you know, what JFK did for television and arguably, you know, Trump has done for Twitter, which is to, you know, use it as a really effective means of communication. And when his voice came over the radio, it was aristocratic, but it was very reassuring. And he was the first guy on the radio who didn't shout on the radio. And he didn't talk like this, you know, like a pompous politician. And he understood that with the invention of the microphone, you could have a more intimate conversation with the American people.
You know, as you can imagine, there's been a ton of interest in the first 100 days. And I put the question of, I mentioned on both on Twitter and Facebook and social media that we were going to talk about it this week. And a bunch of people sent me questions for you. If you have the time, I'd love to ask you some of them. John Yingling of Norristown, Pennsylvania, and Ryan Butcher of Tulsa, Oklahoma, both wondered, other than FDR, has any president enacted significant legislation in his first 100 days? And the other part of it, I was going to say, who would you say other than FDR had the most productive first 100?
I would say Lyndon Johnson and then Barack Obama. So Lyndon Johnson's first 100 days is a little bit confusing since, you know, he became president on November 22nd, 1963, and so his 100 days didn't start then. And I think the fair way to assess him in terms of 100 days would be what happened after January 20th, 1965. And in that period, after he'd been elected in his own right, they passed the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which was their first real aid to education from Washington, and a huge piece of legislation. And then the other thing that happened at that time was that they had Bloody Sunday on the bridge from Selma to Montgomery, and Johnson gave the best speech of his presidency, where he said, you know, their struggle must be our struggle too, and we shall overcome. And that set the stage for the Voting Rights Act, which was not actually in the first 100 days. So 1965 was an astonishingly productive year legislatively. But I think that 2009 was also huge. And if you just look at Obama's first 100 days, you know, you have the stimulus, which people kind of tend to run down, but it injected close to $1 trillion into the American economy. It was a massive piece of legislation. It was the biggest energy bill of all time, the biggest jobs bill of all time. We could talk for the whole show, Ken, about the Recovery Act of 2009. It's been a much maligned piece of legislation, which arguably helped save the economy. And even before that, even before Obama's first 100 days actually started, when he was still president-elect, he lobbied through a $350 billion bank rescue, which was the second part of a TARP program that had started under President Bush. Then, still in the first 100 days, you had the auto bailouts, which were huge. And those loan guarantees saved the American auto industry. And like the bank bailouts, they were paid back to the taxpayers, even though nobody thought that at the time. So that was a hugely eventful 100 days.
I have a question here from Scott Parker of Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he says, and this is basically getting at what you were just saying now, he says, how predictive is the first 100 days? Are there presidents who, with successful first 100 days who later turned out to be a disaster, or vice versa? And I was, and actually, when he was asking that question, I was thinking of President Kennedy in the Bay of Pigs in 1961.
Right. So both President Kennedy and President Clinton had very difficult first 100 days. Kennedy suffered the fiasco at the Bay of Pigs, where Cuban exiles with the backing of the U.S. military tried and failed to retake Cuba from Castro. But Kennedy's reaction to that was to admit error, apologize, and even though he'd had this terrible failure, he went to 83% popularity, the highest popularity of any president in his first 100 days, because he had showed some humility. It is somewhat predictive, and you know, I think it's by itself, it's not a very meaningful standard. It's arbitrary, 100 days, but what it is it's our first impression of a president, and first impressions count, because the first impression really dictates what happens in that first year. And if the 100 days are not that significant, the first year is critically important. And pretty much every president, we've had a sense after the first year of how it's going to go for them, because once they get into a midterm election year, it's really hard to get a lot of big things done. And so you're going to know pretty much after the first year whether the president is going to be successful or not.
You know, we mentioned a lot about Donald Trump, and there's one more question I want to throw in. This is from Frank Ricciopi of somewhere in New Jersey. He doesn't say where, but he wants to know, and I've never thought of this either, how many presidents in recent history have publicly disclosed a 100-day plan? I don't remember that ever.
Yeah, well, that has not been done in the past, mostly because Roosevelt's successors, most of them resented the 100-day frame. So, you know, John F. Kennedy in his inaugural address said, you know, we're not going to get this done in the first 100 days or the first 1,000 days or our lifetimes on this planet. He felt crowded by Roosevelt. Like, don't tell me we have to get all this done in 100 days. And the others felt the same way. They were very cranky on the subject of 100 days. Obama called it a Hallmark holiday. So none of them, until Trump, you know, made these elaborate promises that they couldn't keep about what they would accomplish in the first 100 days.
Jonathan Alter is a longtime journalist, as well as the author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. John, it was wonderful having you on the program.
Great talking to you. I'm happy to come back anytime.
Okay, well, I'll see you in the next 100 days.
Okay.
Thanks, John.
Okay, take care.
I never thought I'd live to be 100. I never thought I'd get to do the things that all those other sons do. And they do. I never thought I'd ever have my freedom. An age ago, my maker was with you.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content, including past episodes of the show, and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.